This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how are you this Friday afternoon? Kate Forrester with you for the Country Hour. Right around the state, it's great to be back with you. It's been a while since I've been in the chair. And coming up on the program today, a fair bit to get through. In just a moment, Michael Lamont, author of the Giwa Crop Report, will be along to give his assessment of this year's grain season so far, saying production potential has fallen away over the last month, and that's due to the ongoing dry conditions over large areas of the southern Kwinana South port zone, the Great Southern and the Lakes District. So if you're in those areas or you just want to let me know what's going on at your place at this point of the season, you can be part of the program. Text 0448 922 604. 6 past 12 here on the Country Hour this Friday afternoon right around Western Australia. And to start with today, the Cooperative Bulk Handling Group has today unveiled one of the biggest rail investments in its history. 17 new custom-built narrow-gauge locomotives and 650 grain wagons are to be added to the network, helping move more WA grain from paddocks to its four ports. CBH Chief Operations Officer Mick Dore says it's a significant investment for the cooperative, which is helping to prepare for bigger crops in the future.
This is a massive investment for the co-op, and it's a critical part of our Path to 33 strategy. And we looked at this in the early 20s when we started to get the bigger crops as to how we're going to move into port, and doubling our fleet size is a critical part of that, and our ability to get tons to all four ports across WA is super important, and this is one of the levers that unlocks that potential and extra tons to port.
Well, tell me a little bit about where we're standing today and what you're actually unveiling, because you can probably hear in the background there's a lot going on.
There is. So we're at MGC, our metro facility in Forestfield, and what we've got behind us is one of our standard our narrow-gauge locomotives, which is one of 17. We've also got some wagons behind that, which is some of the 650 wagons that we've also procured as part of this investment. There's 17 narrow-gauge locos. Like I said, there's another 7 standard-gauge locos that are still to arrive, which will make up the total investment. So that gives us nearly 19 fleets across WA to enable us to move tons to port. So it's a massive increase in our fleet size and great investment.
Yeah, I was going to say, how big of an investment is it, like in terms of CBH history?
Yeah, so it doubles our fleet size. So in 2010, we brought our first fleet. It's in excess of $400 million that we spent on this fleet enhancement. And it's a great milestone for the co-op and where we're going to go in the future and our ability to handle the bigger crops.
Why do you think now was the right time to unveil something like this?
Yeah, so like I said, in early 21, we started to get bigger crops, over 20 million tonne. We've started to see bigger and bigger crops consistently, and our planning started then to sort of work out what we needed to increase the size of the fleet, and these things take time, and I guess we're starting to see the benefits of that investment now starting to come through based on the planning and the building of this infrastructure. It's taken 2 or 3 years and started to arrive now, which is very timely.
Where do you reckon these locos and the wagons will be operating in WA?
Yeah, so right across the state. The first lot of the narrow-gauge fleet has gone down to Albany, the locomotives. We've got a lot of the wagons in the Kwinana zone, the Geraldton zone, so we've swapped out some of the older wagons that we've had around the place. So, yeah, we will see these operate in those three zones particularly. Esperance has a lot smaller rail program, which is... That'll free up some of our older fleet that we can send down there to also operate rail. So we'll have all four zones operating.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, Mick. What happens now to that older fleet?
Still using full throttle. So like I said, that now enables us to have 19 fleets. The older fleet will definitely still get highly utilised, and this just enables us to be more flexible, more productive. And, we did have 3 fleets from Horizon as part of our partnership with them. They will get phased out as we bring this newer sort of grain-specific fleet into production.
And what does this mean for growers at the end of the day? Is it going to reduce the cost for them from getting grain from paddock to port?
Yeah, look, it's we want to make sure we maintain pressure on downward pressure on cost for freight, and it's one of the bigger costs that growers face each year. And you know, we definitely have everything we can to try and keep that down. It also, really importantly, is about getting tons to port at the right time. And, you know, we believe that growers maximise their returns when they get the tons to the port in the front half of the year and or when the market determines that. And that's what we're trying to do, is unlock the capacity, increase our capacity at ports and release, you know, those options. And the fleet gives us that ability to do that. And we've seen that over the last few months with increases in our tons to port. We've had 2.5 million tonne earlier this year. We just did a record in July of 2 million tonne. You know, so we're seeing consistently those volumes increase, which is what enables growers to maximise their returns.
And this is state federal funding that has helped get this off the ground. What do you see, you know, going forward for CBH? Any challenges kind of maintaining these?
Yeah, look, I think the state and federal funding has really helped us with the railway line piece. So we've had our rapid rail facilities, which is also a critical part of this investment. The important part there is to continue to see that investment into the track and ensure that we get the productivity on the below rail as well. So, you know, we want to make sure that these locomotives operate at the right speed, we can carry the right amount of tonnes on the wagons, we can increase that and increase our productivity right across the network. And that's really important, and why it's important that we continue to partner with the feds and state government, which has been great to date.
Well, yeah, talking about the state government, the Transport Minister, Rita Safiotti, has just been chatting about how these are world leading in terms of the lighting on them, and it's such a great thing for CBH to have done. How confident are you, though, that the lighting that are on these new locomotives and wagons actually are going to match the legislation that could pass for train rail lighting?
Yeah, I think for us, importantly, you know, we've done a lot of work to make sure that the lighting that we've put on these locos and retrofitted our old locos are safe and don't bring unintended consequences to other road users, but most importantly, they serve the purpose of what they're meant to, which is make the locos more visible. And, you know, it's a multi-pronged approach, as Ben spoke to, in terms of road safety, rail safety. But again, you know, we spend a lot of time with a lot of people making sure that the lighting was fit for purpose and achieve what we set out to achieve. And you know, we're really pleased with that. Not taking away from the whole thing about the locos themselves are also world-class. These narrow-gauge locos got a cab at each end, which also overcomes the safety issue that our drivers had with what they called long-end leading. So yeah, there's lots of other things that have been introduced into these locos, which is really important.
What makes lighting world class, though? This word keeps coming up today. It's world class. What makes it world class?
Yeah, so we had these locomotives built in Brazil. Company Wabtec, who have built them, who are also one of the major locomotive producers in the US. Our standard gauge locos are also a US company. They've all commented that the lighting on our locomotives is well in excess of anything that they've produced for their locos, and they've got a large amount of the world market in locomotives. And you know, in Brazil, the factory we went to, the leader of the factory was really complimentary of our lighting and said that they are the most lit up locomotive she's ever seen. So you know, and we've also had you know, confirmation from a lot of the industry that they are you know, well lit up and a lot more lit up than anything that they produce.
And I mean, to finish off with today, Mick, have you had a look inside and had a go, I don't know, on the track?
Not on the track, unfortunately. It's still to come, but absolutely been inside. Really impressed with how they're laid out. I think we got really good driver feedback to date on how they perform, and you know, that's really, really exciting for us. And you know, we expect to see, you know, really good productivity out of these, and want to make sure that we see them out in regional WA consistently and often.
But not you behind the wheel.
Well, they don't have a wheel, do they, on a track?
You can clearly tell I haven't been inside one.
Yeah, that's the beauty of a train. But do hope to get on there at some point, and really look forward to that.
Oh, Mick, thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour today, and enjoy the new fleet.
Not a worry. Thank you very much.
CBH Chief Operations Officer Mick Dore speaking to me earlier this morning about the new locos and the wagons that they've just unveiled. And maybe I should have popped a question in there of how you actually operate these, because clearly I need that answered. Now, this program will take CBH's owned rail fleet to 49 locomotives in total and 1,222 wagons. And you heard me talking just then about how one of the standouts on the new fleet is the lighting. And that's pretty timely because if you've been listening to the Country Hour the past couple of days, you would have heard the Rail Safety Bill has been debated in Parliament this week. Now, that bill is all about enforcing better lighting on trains and on rolling stock. Well, the Deputy Premier and Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti was also at this morning's CBH proceedings, and she thinks the new fleet ticks all the boxes when it comes to lighting.
I've had the opportunity to go out and see them both in the dark and now during the day, and I think you can all agree they are super impressive. So again, the investment in the new locomotives, the new wagons, are all again making sure that not only are they fit for purpose today, but they can drive outcomes into the future. I know it's a topic of the week, so I'll talk about the visibility of these locomotives. I've had the opportunity to see them at night. And again, the world leading lighting that is placed on these locomotives and being retrofitted to the other locomotives on the network, again, make these locomotives the most visible and world-leading when it comes to train lighting. And again, a big recognition to all of those at CBH for, in a sense, helping drive the agenda and lead the agenda when it comes to train lighting. So congratulations to them as well. The other key part, of course, is not only is it your locomotives and your wagons, it's actually the loading facilities and work to make sure that grain and product can go from farm to port as quickly as possible to maximise price. Not only is that good for the farmer, it's good for CBH, but it's also good for the state economy. And we know that the agriculture sector continues to play a key role in the state economy and the national economy. And I just know when we've had a bad harvest year, what it does to the state GSP numbers, and it's not a good sign. So we hope again for a good season this year because it very much drives our state economy numbers and also feeds into the national economic figures.
WA's Deputy Premier and Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti. What are your thoughts on what the Deputy Premier just had to say and what CBH had to say? And actually, just more broadly, what are your thoughts on what they're trying to do with its grain on rail initiatives? I'm interested to hear from you, this arvo. 0448 922 604 is the text number. If you want to get in contact, just put your name and where you're texting from on that, because it's always good to hear from you. 17 past 12. Now, let's stay with the grains industry now, because GIWA, which is the Grain Industry Association, I should say, of Western Australia, has just released its August crop report, which shows there is now a stark divide between the very good northern and eastern areas and the struggling Great Southern. Report author Michael Lamont says despite the dry July and recent cold weather knocking potential off the state's grain crop, farmers are still expected to harvest more than 21 million tonnes this season. But he does say there are nervous weeks ahead if the pattern of clear skies and lack of cloud cover continues.
Yeah, last month the crops deceptively good. Things were still going okay. You know, the crop, there hadn't still been a lot of rain by then, pretty good rain in June, you know, and then and it was quite warm, so the crops were ticking along pretty well. There still was that really dry area. Well, initially it was from Beverley to Bremer Bay, and then it was just, it contracted over, you know, during June as more and more rain fell. But, you know, there was still that really core area in the Great Southern around Nowangerup and Wagen and a bit further east that was, you know, and still hasn't, a lot of those areas have only had 120 mil year-to-date rainfall. So things weren't too bad. But what's happened in the last month is that a lot of the crops have gone backwards where they were struggling anyway. You know, we had one of the driest Julys on record, cold weather. The good areas are still good. That's sort of the eastern areas, the kind of northeast zone, so out east, northeast, north, Esperance, west coast, still good. But the, the shine's really come off it in the last month, particularly, you know, south of the Great Eastern Highway in those really dry areas.
The report says the season is very much in balance. So how much has that dry July, the cold weather, knocked off WA's crop potential?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's often is in the balance this time of the year, of course, but it it really is at the moment because the lack of subsoil moisture. If you look at any sort of soil maps of the WA, it's all red and black, which is not good. There's just nothing there. So in areas where the crops are late and they haven't got a lot of top, well, they're really going to struggle. And areas that have got a lot of top and they haven't got much subsoil moisture, they're going to struggle too because, when the heat comes on, they'll just transplant themselves to death. And the areas that haven't really grown well, they're just going to run out of time. So it's quite in the balance in that respect. The other one is that the sort of subtle change from sort of warmish sort of weather to these cold fronts that are licking through and not really doing much except providing cold, cold air and clear skies, well, that's not a really good change in trend for frost. So on one hand, the crops have slowed down, so they're sort of a little bit later than they were last month. So they're pushing out of that frost window a little, but they're going to be very susceptible over the next sort of 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks. A lot of balls in the air, but I mean, there are some good areas too, some very good areas. Geraldton Port Zone's fantastic. That whole eastern Midlands area, the West Midlands not so good, but most of the Midlands area is very, very good, right down all through that northeast Cunard Port Zone, like I was saying, north of Meriden, out east of Meriden, down Esperance is having another crack a year. So, yeah, there's some still pretty good areas around the place.
Just driving around, Michael, what are you noticing about what the crops are looking like at the moment, just after the frost damage, but also the drier July?
Yeah, well, I mean, the frost damage, there hasn't probably been a lot of frost damage yet because the crops weren't particularly vulnerable. It's more the change in the seasonal trend is the worry, the clear skies and cold air coming into flowering. So, yes, there's some definitely canola that's been damaged, that's been smoked in the southern areas, just the seeds just gone to water, but that's not widespread just yet. I mean, one thing that is quite noticeable is the a lot of the crops are really looking washed out now, and that is a function of the kerfuffle about fertiliser at the start of the year, the price and the supply. And, there were very good levels of organic N available, a lot higher than normal, and that was a good thing. The seasonal outlook wasn't great. The price of nitrogen was high. Yeah, so what's that starting to, come home to roost now? Because a lot of crops are looking very washed out, particularly the wheat, just hasn't got the nutrition. And that high nitrogen use over the last 5 to 7 years, there's 30% more nitrogen use now than there was 5 years ago, has been one of the main drivers of yield. And so that's going to put a damper on the top end this year, particularly with the cereals, mainly the wheat. So that's quite noticeable now. I suppose growers were reticent to keep applying N when it was so dry in July. There's still probably some topping up to do, but, you've got to be pretty confident of that rainfall and what's under you to be able to keep topping up and spending dollars and not get the return. So the crops, they do look a bit gappy. We're actually between York and Northam, and, we had a good start, but crops have really turned in the last couple of weeks. They're just haven't got the density. They're already deciding that, okay, we ain't going to try and push it too hard here. So the canola looks gappy. There's air, and there's, the cereals do as well. So they're starting to go off a little. Can't just focus on the bad areas. I mean, the good areas are still very good.
And you're still forecasting more than 21 million tonnes of grain for the state, which includes on-farm seed and feed. But we're still on track for that large crop.
Oh, well, see, what it is, we don't really forecast as such. It's more, what does it look like today? The growth stage of the crops, the health of the crops. So what's the potential today? So the potential still is there. It's one of the largest crops sown ever. So just under 9.5 million hectares. There's a lot of barley. The barley was going to make up the tonnes. I think still there'll be more than 50% of the tonnes will come from barley and canola, but the majority of the cereal in those really poor areas is barley, of course. So, where we could have been absolutely having a real cracker of a bar, could have gone to 8 million tonne is going to probably struggle to get 6 now. At the moment, we have about 21 million is potentially could be produced this year. We're going to have a reasonable spring to do that and not have too much frost impact. It's still a lot of tonnes. Certainly very little chance hitting any of those top-end tonnage years of 22 and last year and whatever. But, you know, if we can get 20 million tonne, that'll be a pretty good result. I've sort of got a feeling it probably won't hit that, just the way the crops are starting to change already. But you never know. You know, we've had a couple of really neat finishes in the last 5 to 7 years where we just haven't had the heat. So, you know, that could happen again. And if that does and a bit more rain, well, you know, happy days.
Michael Lamond, author of GIWA's monthly crop report, speaking to Olivia Thorne. And in some news just in, the Royal Agricultural Society of WA has just come out and announced it's decided to cancel its poultry competition this year. Now, given all that's happening with bird flu across the country, I don't think that's a huge surprise. Even though the absence of recent detections of the H5 bird flu in WA in recent weeks is encouraging, the society says it's decided to take a precautionary approach. So avoiding the movement of birds around the state does seem to be a sensible move. So just repeating, the Royal Ag Society of WA have announced it's decided to cancel its poultry competition this year.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
25 past 12. Woolworths has decided to scrap its Farmers Own milk brand. That will only affect a few dairy farmers in WA, but the announcement has prompted Australian Dairy Farmers President Ben Bennett to call for our major supermarket companies to offer genuine support to Aussie farmers. He says, unfortunately, at the moment, they're not competing on a level global playing field, and so he's not surprised Woolies has gone down this path.
I feel that Woolies were trying to appeal to the general Australian community, that they had a more closer association with Australian dairy farmers. They had suppliers across the country, but in all fairness, it was very few. Okay, so I think it was really more of a very much a token exercise in them creating a perspective of how close that association is with farmers per se. And I think they were giving a significant bonus or premium, but I think with the competitive nature of where the industry's at, yeah, they've chosen commercially, economically, or maybe whatever other reason to discontinue.
And Ben, do you think that this decision by Woolies to discontinue the brand shows that that way of sort of operating with suppliers doesn't work, or do you think it's just that it was sort of too small and too niche sort of situation?
Well, very much so. It was tiny. Yeah, in the greater scheme of things, yeah, like their market dominance with Coles is just gigantic, and you've got to look at the broader picture of dairy, and it's really just a drop in the bucket. It's just really tokenism. Like the dairy cabinet's far bigger than just simply drinking milk. You know, the importation of the product, be it butter or cheese from overseas, is pretty apparent, particularly in their respective home brands and stuff like that. So I think they were just doing a bit of a PR sort of situation as opposed to having any credible, significant financial improvement to the dairy industry of Australia.
What sort of thing do you think needs to happen then with the supermarkets to improve that situation then, you know, with the consumers and dairy farmers? Do you think there is a way, or is it sort of got way past that now?
Well, you always got to have hope, but over the last 20 years, dairy's very fragile and has been in decline, and there's been plenty of people well before me who've been trying to sort of say to the powers that be, i.e. the governments, be they state or federal, and particularly federal, is that we're in a, quite frankly, in a dire situation, and it's getting worse. Like this EU free trade, I don't know how many people are aware, but last year we imported just short of $1 billion from Europe. Like, people think Europe's a net importer of agriculture food. Well, on dairy, they certainly are not. And a third of their incomes are government subsidised. And I can't see how it's fair, this EU free trade. And then we read it in, you know, today or yesterday's paper, they're chipping in $1 billion to help out Rio on a aluminium smelter. Like, hey, I think food and dairy are pretty essential to the population of a continent, and we can't get that right. Like, our cost structure here in Australia does not make us competitive with the world, and they just continue to endear us with more regulations and supposed free trade deals, which might, you know, help them buy European cars cheaper in Canberra, but I don't know, the rest of us are probably moving towards peasantry, aren't we?
Yeah, it's interesting that, as you mentioned, about the cheaper imported dairy that's coming and then it's competing with the Australian dairy on the shelves, and that then obviously has a flow-on effect. What do you
think? Well, our processors, they have to have a lick of the ice cream too, to mind the pun. Like, you know, they've got to make money out of this too. And it's sort of very frustrating with Woolies own, you know, they're trying to be very sort of self-righteous and virtuous, as we know the supermarkets, and they're very good at it. Like, they've got the smartest people in the room, but yeah, the industry continues to slide. Like, it's, we need some genuine input from our, particularly the two largest supermarkets, but you know, Aldi's there on the side. Like, they're not a small player anymore, and we need a bit of cooperation if we're going to have a genuine product of Australia other than the rep that it's wrapped around.
So you think they really need to step up to make sure that Australian products continue to be on the shelf?
We have to do something different, more of the same, you know, and having these little niche brands where they make out they're patronising us little farmers, well, we've got to look at the bigger issue.
Australian Dairy Farmers President Ben Bennett speaking to Justine Longmore about Woolworths' decision to scrap its farmers' own milk brand, which has been around for the last 13 years. 29-1. And Jonathan Hopper, happy Friday to you. What's making headlines this afternoon?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Kate. The Productivity Commission has labelled the federal government's GST deal with Western Australia a costly mistake and called for its reversal. The commission says it's cost the federal budget $23 billion over 6 years and is unfair to other states. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he'll wait for the final report in December, but has promised WA its fair share. And as you've mentioned, Kate, the Perth Royal Show will not hold its poultry competition this year as a precaution against H5N1 bird flu. The Royal Agricultural Society of WA says the poultry competition would normally bring about 750 birds from around 80 exhibitors to Claremont Showground. It says avoiding this movement of birds around the state is the most responsible approach this year. And the theft of copper from lighting at a Geraldton football ground has caused $70,000 damage and forced games to be rescheduled. Geraldton police say a person forced entry to an electrical box and caused significant damage by cutting and stealing electric cables. Repairs are expected to take some weeks. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Landline explores the National Soil Archive, where the oldest sample just turned 100.
Yeah, we did celebrate. Yeah.
Did you?
We had a little team party.
Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
All of that coming up on this Sunday's program. And also on this Sunday's show, you're going to find out about some interesting research going on in space. Christy O'Brien will take a look at one of the big challenges for lengthy space travel trips: food. Research is being conducted across Australia trying to figure out how to grow food for astronauts, which I think is just wild. So that coming up on Sunday's Landline program. But coming up now, we're going to head to the Bureau to get a bit of an update on what's happening on the weather front this afternoon and into the weekend. Catherine Schellfout is with me this Friday afternoon. Catherine, let's start in the Southwest Land Division. What's going on?
Hi, Kate. Yeah, it's been another cold start this morning. So there were a few places that dropped below zero last night. I noticed Westdale, Wandering and Aimlup, but there were a few others. But yeah, the cold and the frost, not as widespread as earlier in the week. And at the moment, we've got some cloud over eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division, but generally a mostly sunny, dry day, and we've got light east-northeasterly winds. So the next couple of days are pretty similar. We've got a high sitting in the Bight and a ridge along the south coast, and that's just slowly moving east. So for tomorrow, Saturday, we'll see light east to northeasterly winds. We've got temperatures around 20 in the Great Southern, increasing up to about 24 in the central west. And then on Sunday, winds turning a little bit more northerly, so north-northeasterly, tiny bit stronger, sort of light to moderate and a bit gusty. And, of course, with the winds being a bit more north, we'll see temperatures a little warmer. So now we're looking at around 21 through the Great Southern, places like Narrogin, up to about 26 degrees at Geraldton on Sunday. So no rain for Saturday or Sunday. And in terms of overnight temperatures, it really just looks like the area just at the east of the hills around York and Northam getting down to 1 or 2 degrees tonight. So a little bit of frost area there. On Monday, we've got a cold front moving through, so the European model is bringing it around 8 a.m. at the southwest capes, and our Australian model is suggesting a few hours later, so they'll come into line in the next day or two. But basically, the front moving across the southwest land division during Monday day and afternoon into the evening. So we'll see winds starting off moderate to fresh and gusty northerly ahead of that front, and then they'll sort of be quite gusty northwesterly and then turn westerly as the front moves through. We do get a ridge coming in quite quickly behind the front, so those winds will drop right off overnight on Monday. But rainfall, I'm sure, is the most important factor that we're looking at. So unfortunately, not huge totals, but we've got 5 to 10 millimetres southwest of about Lancelin to Walpole, and maybe up to 15 millimetres in the far southwest corner of the state. For people sort of further inland through the wheat belt, we're looking at maybe 3 to 6 millimetres southwest of about Geraldton to Narrogin to Albany. And if you're a bit further out, places like Dalwalla New, Bruce Rock, Lake Grace, looking at about 1 to 3 millimetres.
And what about in the northern and eastern forecast districts?
Sorry, Kate, I'm just going to finish Tuesday, if that's all right.
Too busy. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. Tuesday, we just got that ridge moving in quickly. Another cold morning. Yeah, not too much going on. Quite a cold day, though. And I was just going to mention that there are a couple more fronts coming through early Wednesday and then Thursday. Not great producers of rain, but we might see a couple of millimetres out of those.
Oh, well, lucky I didn't.
Go to the north.
I was going to say, lucky I didn't cut you off for that. That's important. The northern and eastern forecast districts, though, Catherine.
Yeah, so at the moment there's just a trough lying over the Western Kimberley and Pilbara. That trough is extending up into the middle levels of the atmosphere and dragging down some moisture from the northwest. So the main weather we've got across the state at the morning is sitting today over the interior. So we're expecting to see some rain and chance of a thunderstorm out through those parts. Not very populated areas, but it does affect Giles and Warburton. Once that trough's gone after tomorrow, we get back to pretty sunny conditions, just light easterly winds. But with the cold front coming through southern WA on Monday, we will see some westerly winds picking up across the Gascoyne. And just a chance for shower getting to far western parts of the Pilbara and through the Gascoyne, southern Goldfields and Eucla on Monday. So that's about it for northern and eastern parts.
Thanks so much for running through that with me, Catherine. Richard Hudson, you may not have much good news for me, I don't think, today.
No, in the 24 hours up until 9 o'clock this morning, nowhere in WA recorded any rain at all. And I did ask Catherine for a specific forecast for Perth Stadium for tonight at 10 past 6. And she said...
The chance of flags.
She said it'll be cold but dry. So, yeah, anyway. Hey, as part of National Science Week, which starts tomorrow, the ABC is running a poll trying to see what is Australia's most amazing wildflower. And one of the nominees is Mullumulla. It has a beautiful, soft, fluffy, pink, purple flower and spikes that sort of remind me a bit of small feather dusters, and it always looks glorious in photos against red dirt. So it's pretty, but it's also good for restoring soils, and it's a great winter feed for livestock, mainly because it's high in protein and sulphur. But back in 2011, so we're talking 15 years ago, Matty Brand visited Fossil Downs Station in the Kimberley, where Bob McDonald was vacuuming Mullumulla seeds as part of a program trying to grow as many of them as he could across his cattle property.
Mullumulla is a very pretty plant that tourists often take photographs of because it grows alongside the road. It's a tall-headed plant, a lovely purpley lilac colour, large fleshy leaves and stems, and it usually grows to about 500 mils in height, and it can spread over a width of probably about 400 mils. But tourists see it as a very pretty plant alongside the road.
And cattlemen see it as what?
Cattlemen don't see it because, as a rule, because the cattle love to eat it and continual grazing wipes it out. And when you see the mulla mulla grazing, growing alongside the road, have a look at the fence, have a look over the fence, and you'll find there's no mulla mulla growing in the paddock. If there is the plant there, it means that the pastoralist has been moving his cattle and given it a chance to recover.
So, as you point out, the amount of mulla mulla across northern Australia has been declining, but that's sort of quite the opposite here at Fossil Downs, and not by accident. Can you explain what you've been doing here over the years?
Some years ago, John Henwood decided and found that he had to keep moving cattle off a designated area to another place, another paddock. And once he did that, he found that the mulla mulla that had been grazed was recovering. So he took notice of this, and prior to that, John and I had been trying to establish mulla mulla for years on the place, and not very successfully. But once found that the cattle were shifted and it started to regrow, it sparked up the interest in it, and we went from there, and we finally developed a method of harvesting the seed and regenerating the plant back on the station in areas where we think it would grow and be beneficial to have it growing there.
You've actually been out in the paddocks hand harvesting seed from a native pasture?
Yes, it's all hand harvested. We use a vacuum machine to harvest the seed. But first of all, we have to have a large dead area of the plant in order to find sufficient seed to make it worthwhile. It's quite hard work, very dusty, and it's a difficult job to harvest the seed. And because of the nature of the flowering characteristic of the plant, you don't get much seed per plant, so it's quite a business.
And spread by hand?
Spread by hand or through the aeroplane over selected areas, and so far aerial inspection the other day showed that we've had magnificent success. Very happy with the success of aerial sowing.
You've told me that mulla mulla likes disturbed soil, hard soil, even salty conditions, but you said it also performs really well in areas that are a bit prone to erosion. Now, that's what I'm interested in. What sort of effects are you seeing the mulla mulla having on these really bare earth kind of spots?
Well, first of all, the mulla mulla is a fleshy type plant, and we've found that it contains a huge amount of moisture in the seed and as well as the green material of the plant itself. And in order to obtain this moisture, it must have a fantastic root system underground. The soil's been too hard to extract the roots out of that soil, but indications are that it's extensive. And accordingly, on the scalded, eroded country, it certainly stops any further erosion taking place. And if you have some good plants on the eroded area, those branches and leaves on the ground trap seed blowing into the area, and again it helps re-establish grasses and herbage on the area. So there's multiple effects there.
That helicopter there is not off to throw some mulla mulla out, is it?
It will be later on in the wet.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
The patches that I've seen, it seems like the mulla mulla is almost the only plant willing to give some of those patches a go.
It is. Yes, we've tried extensively with other plants, all native plants, and mulla mulla is the one that goes. It has a variable germination rate in the seed, so you don't always have success the first year. Sometimes you might have a few plants the first year, but a lot the second year. So all the project is aimed at long term, and naturally it depends entirely on seasonal conditions. And one of the main reasons why we want mulla mulla back, apart from its soil stabilising characteristics, is the fact that we've found through plant analyses that it contains high protein level, much higher than the surrounding pastures at any time of the year, and also it contains a high percentage of sulphur when compared to any other plants. And this sulphur is an important element for digestion, particularly in the third stomach for the cattle, and it aids digestion of fibrous material. And at this time of the year, when the grasses are dry and very low in protein, any assistance from sulphur or protein in the plant is a great help for the cattle condition.
Oh, I loved hearing the chopper in the background there. It really feels like you're there, don't you think? That was Bob McDonald from Fossil Down Station speaking to Matt Brand back in 2011. And Matty chatted with Bob this week, and he is now living in Dubbo. And if you're wondering, Moola Moola, it actually looks a little bit like lavender. I'm sure you can find a photo online as well. Fossil Down Station is about 50 kilometres northeast of Fitzroy Crossing in the Kimberley, and the property is now owned by Hancock Agriculture. And National Science Week 2026 actually starts from tomorrow. So part of the ABC program, it's running a poll to find out which wildflower you think is the most amazing. So if you'd like to put your, you know, vote in or have your say, just search ABC Science and Wildflower Poll. The winning flower will be announced on a special Hour of Flower on Radio National and a live blog on ABC News Online from midday next Friday.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Quarter to one on the Country Hour. And let's head now to the far south of the state, because it's full steam ahead for Medallion Metals' Ravensthorpe Gold Project. Managing Director Paul Bennett says they now have all the required key approvals in place, and so underground mining should start in the next 6 months.
We hope to commence the development this month in August of 2026, and then most likely cut the portal into the underground mine in November.
And you're able to do that because you've just awarded quite a significant contract, I think around $240 million for that underground mining.
Yeah, that's correct. We've selected McMahon as our preferred underground contractor. That the final contracting document's yet to be finalised, but we expect to enter into those in the next couple of weeks. But they will be the underground mining contractor at the project for the first 3 years of its life.
And, of course, in terms of processing that ore, you've purchased the Forrestania former nickel and current gold project east of Hyden or north of Varley, and retrofitting that processing plant. So are you on track to have that come on stream at the same time?
Yes, that's correct. So there's two key work streams underway at Forrestania, repurposing the former Cosmic Boy concentrator, which was set up to treat nickel ores from the mines around Forrestania. We are repurposing that to recover gold. We'll undertake toll treatment activities there through October of 2026 through to around June, July 2027. In the meantime, in parallel, the plant's being expanded and modified to treat the Ravensthorpe ore, which is slightly different to the material it would be treating initially. The site civil works have commenced there for the expanded plant footprint. And then once we award the procure and construct contract, EPC contract, in coming weeks, then those engineering firms will mobilise to site as well and undertake those works.
Paul, looking at the timeline, by this time next year, you're hopeful that you'll be a gold producer. Are you excited to bring copper and gold production back to Ravensthorpe, which is a very traditional gold-producing region?
Yeah, very aware of the history and the legacy of the gold and the copper mines. I think it's tremendously significant that this is coming back. You know, we want to be here for a long period of time, so we want this business to be sustainable. We think with the grades and the economics of the project, it can operate in all sorts of commodity price environments. So that bodes well. But it is exciting. I mean, even from Medallion's own point of view, the company's been present and investing in the Ravensthorpe area for a decade now, and to see it now come to fruition is really gratifying from our team's point of view, and also, you know, we're very pleased for the way things are going for the shareholders and the local community as well.
Medallion Metals Managing Director Paul Bennett speaking with Tara DeLandgraft. And he thinks when they get to peak production towards the end of next year, they'll probably be employing around 160 to 170 people at the Ravensthorpe mine and another 60 to 70 people at the Forrestania processing plant, which is 150 kilometres to the north. Electricians and mechanical service staff at South 32's Worsley Alumina Refinery are threatening to strike if they don't get a pay increase that matches their counterparts at Alcoa. The Electrical Trades Union has lodged a protected action ballot order with the Fair Work Commission, claiming the mining company has not acted in good faith with its members who have been negotiating a new agreement since March. Now, this comes after the announcement of the merger between Alcoa and South 32, which is set to be finalised by the middle of next year. The union's WA secretary, Adam Woodidge, says strike is still a last resort option.
So what's happened is we've hit an impasse with South 32 at the Worsley Alumina Refinery, and now members have instructed the ETU along with the AMWU to file for protected action to participate in potential strike action.
How many electricians are we talking?
Circa around about 60 on day shift and also on shift work. And then with the mechanical people, you're talking anywhere upwards of about 140. So probably around a workforce of about 200 plus.
And how do you think that will impact operations on the ground on the day of action?
4 years ago, we went down this path of action, and across the dispute over a number of months, we estimate we costed South 32 about $45 million. So it will have an impact on the bottom line to South 32. However, what we're asking for, if our claims were to be met, wouldn't cost $45 million. The nub of the issue is there's a merger on the horizon with Alcoa. These workers now more than ever look at what Alcoa get paid and what they get paid. If you're a day worker working at South 32 at Worsley Alumina, you work 200 hours more a year and you get paid 20% less for doing exactly the same type of craft, the same skills, the same knowledge, it's the same process. If you're a shift worker, it's even worse. A shift worker works an additional 300 hours per annum at South 32 and gets paid 25% less than the same skills at Alcoa. And the members have had enough and they want it fixed up.
And so if we can kind of take a step back here and broaden the view for a second, I know there's been a lot of industrial action across WA, particularly in mine sites. I know there's obviously BHP very recently got a lot of the media attention, but elsewhere as well. Is there sort of a wider discontent across the industry, or is it just that sort of agreements are coming to an end all at the same time?
Yeah.
What's going on there?
It's a great question. I haven't quite got my finger on it. I think it's a combination of multiple levers. I think it is a generational change in the workforce, and the workforce is saying, hey, I want to change what my workplace looks like. I'm just not accepting the status quo anymore. There is also an alignment of agreements expiring at the same time. And I think there's an overall better mood in the mining sector with the workers that unions are here to help. And unions are here to service workers and deliver outcomes for workers, and that's what we're proving time and time again.
Adam Woodidge, WA Secretary of the Electrical Trades Union, speaking to Madigan Landry. No one from South 32 were available for an interview, but the company sent us a statement saying South 32 Worsley Alumina has taken a positive and constructive approach throughout the negotiation process with the aim of reaching a new agreement that supports employees while helping Worsley remain sustainable. It says they have engaged extensively with employees who will have the opportunity to vote on the proposed agreement in the coming days. 7-1. Treasury Wine Estates has reported a $1 billion loss in its full-year financial results, delivered to investors this week. The wine giant, which owns brands such as Penfolds, Wynns and Wolf Blass, posted an overall 36% drop in year-on-year earnings for the last financial year. Treasury's Managing Director, Sam Fisher, says they have decided to fallow vineyards in California, and they are in the process of reducing their global portfolio from 76 wine brands to less than 30.
While this decisive action has impacted financial performance in the short term, I am confident we'll emerge a more focused and financially strong company capable of sustained, attractive returns. Importantly, the underlying performance of our key brands remains strong, with depletions growth continuing for Penfolds, led by China and our Asia markets. And in the US, depletions returned to growth nationally for the year, despite the impact of California distributor transition in the first half. We progressed our previously announced initiatives to ensure brand and channel health, including action to significantly reduce parallel imports into China. Our global supply chain transformation has commenced, and processes to divest a number of non-priority brands and assets are underway, with a pleasing response to date. The decision to reduce US vintage makes from 2026 reflects the type of clear and decisive actions we will be taking to ensure that we improve shareholder return from the Americas.
Treasury Wine Estates Managing Director and CEO Sam Fisher trying to explain to investors that everything is under control after announcing a $1 billion loss.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. One New South Wales town dependent on tourism is battening down the hatches ahead of the arrival of bird flu. In Europe, drought has forced the closure of water-dependent nuclear power plants in Romania. There are reports of US Navy personnel jumping overboard amid food shortages and poor conditions aboard US aircraft carriers. And 5 years on from the withdrawal of Afghanistan, what lessons have been learnt and what ones have not? Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
5 minutes to one, that coming up after the news at 1 o'clock. But before we get there, a merino industry veteran has become the most successful exhibitor ever at a national competition by winning the Supreme Merino Ram title for the third time. Robert Harding from the Glendonald Stud in Western Victoria has also taken out the National Merino Pairs title 5 times. Robert says Glendonald has a long history in the show ring, so he feels very privileged to be part of that legacy.
Paddy McDonald had owned Glendonald. He showed sheep for a long time, and I'm only pleased that, well, it's still going. Yeah, no, it's pleasing to probably, be up there with the best of them, and that's the beauty of shows. You can take your better ones and compare them. It's, I think, pretty good for the advancement of the breed.
And, Robert, how do you feel about the future of the industry? Because it's an interesting time where the sheep flock, and particularly the merino flock, is at the lowest point it's been at a long time in terms of numbers. But on the flip side, the wool price is reasonable, meat prices are excellent. What do you think the future holds?
I'll tell you in 10 years' time, if I'm still about. Yeah, look, I think the future for those that have got a merino flock will be fairly good, because I think the price of wool, even though it's, I don't think it's as good as it needs to be, down the track, I think the wool consumers of the world are going to have to pay a bit more for wool. Otherwise, they're going to find the supply is going to get so much less. The thing at the moment is the price of sheep or meat is so good that a lot of our surplus sheep are all getting their heads cut off. So I can't see how in the near future our sheep flock is going to get much bigger.
Robert Harding from Glendonald Merinos at Neil, which is 373 kilometres west of Melbourne. He was speaking with Angus Verley. Coming up to the news at 1 o'clock, but earlier in the program, I brought you the story about CBH's major investment that they announced this morning into its new locomotives and wagons. And quite a few on the text line wanting to have your say about what you make about this milestone for the co-op. Stephen Kendenup says CBH's trains in the Kendenup area to and from Albany are vibrating houses, roofs and ceiling lights. Even though they are driving the locos as quietly as possible, they vibrate houses and wake people up in the middle of the night. It's a huge amount of noise and vibration. I say fit the lighting to the old light blue locos, which don't vibrate people's windows and ceilings and don't wake people up in the night. Sounds like you're pretty frustrated about that one, Steve. And Peter says, what a pity that CBH didn't buy Australian-made locomotives manufactured in Newcastle. The feedback on the new locomotives is they lack power and the cabs are small and uncomfortable. Thank you, Peter, for that. And also just about the story about the mullamulla, the wildflower here in WA, you heard a little earlier. Elsie says, I absolutely love the mullamulla here in Exmouth. It's so interesting to hear that story. Thanks for texting in. And I love the photos as well, Elise, that you sent through. Thanks so much for being part of the program this Friday afternoon on The Country Hour. Belinda Varischetti will be back with you on Monday, so you can tune in for that. And I'll be with you on the Rural Report if you're in the Great Southern and the Southwest. But until then, I'll chat to you later. 1 o'clock, news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.